probably afraid they were a husband and wife having an argument.
What about the girl's mother? Surely you believe her.
Because she's a woman, you mean?
Grifoni demanded with soft-voiced sarcasm. Before he could answer, she said,
No. As a matter of fact, I don't. I think she probably handed him the knife.
Brunetti was so surprised that it was his turn to set his fork on his plate and stare across the table at her. Where had all of this been hiding for so long?
"That's a bit severe, don't you think, Claudia?" he asked, keeping his voice calm and conversational.
"You read the papers, didn't you? She said she went in to wake her daughter up for school, and when she saw the blood, she screamed and ran out of the house. She'd slept beside her husband and woke up to find her daughter murdered in her bed."
Brunetti nodded. This, indeed, was the story that the papers had printed and were still printing.
"You think he'd come back into the bedroom and slip into bed quietly, Guido? He'd just stabbed his only child 7 times, and he goes back to bed, and his wife doesn't even wake up, and off he goes to sleep?"
Brunetti looked at his pasta, no longer wanting it.
"They found blood all over his pajamas, Guido. Or better, we found blood all over his pajamas, and in their bed, and we found his wife's fingerprints on the handle of the knife."
"She said it was on the floor, and she picked it up without thinking."
"And washed the blood off and put it back in the kitchen drawer? How'd it get into the drawer, Guido? And who washed the blood off?"
The waiter approached their table, but Grifoni waved him away. She opened her mouth, closed it, and then took 5 or 6 very deep breaths. She reached across the table and put her right hand on his arm.
"I'm sorry, Guido, but I get crazy when I have to listen to this."
"To what?"
"To men explaining their violence towards women and expecting people to believe they really didn't have a choice. I'm sick to death of it and sick of people being taken in by it. He murdered her because he was losing control of her. It's as simple as that. Anything else is just smoke in our eyes and an appeal to our desire to feel good about ourselves because we're so tolerant of other cultures. And it's fake, fake, fake."
She stopped and stared at him for a long time, weighing something Brunetti couldn't identify.
"And if I might add, only men are stupid enough to believe it because they feel the same desire to control women and, if truth must be told, secretly sympathize with it."
She beckoned the waiter, and when he came, told him he could take the plates away and bring them 2 coffees. They were very quiet when he picked up the plates. Chapter 19. Both of them preferred to walk. Not bothering to try to exchange idle conversation, they reached Gasparini's home just past 3. Brunetti rang the bell, and soon they were seated in the living room where he had spoken to her.
Had it been only yesterday?
Professoressa Crosera had turned strangely pale. Her hair was the same rich brown, but that only made the other change more obvious. Her skin had faded and resembled parchment. The curves of her cheekbones had been replaced by angles. 2 days had done this to her, Brunetti thought.
"Professoressa Crosera," Brunetti said after refusing what had been a pro forma offer of coffee, "we'd like you to talk about your husband."
She looked at Brunetti, then at Grifoni, then back to Brunetti, as though waiting for him to translate what he'd said into a language she could understand.
"What do you mean?"
she finally asked. Even her voice was gray, with the flat inertia of lack of sleep and constant fear.
"I found the man who was selling drugs at the school," Brunetti said.
Her eyes leaped back to his face, and she said,
"Did he do it?"
Brunetti shook his head.
"It would be impossible for him. He's very sick."
"Is he in the hospital?"
she asked, and Brunetti wondered if she would try to find him there and do him harm.
He was. He's having chemotherapy.
Wanting to test her, he added,
but it doesn't look like there's any chance it's going to be of any help to him.
Good,
she said savagely. Brunetti was at a loss how to respond. As if she had not spoken, he went on.
He isn't capable of having attacked your husband, I'm sure of that.
So?
It has to have been someone else.
Professoressa Crosera turned her attention from him and asked Grifoni,
Did I surprise you with what I just said about him?
Brunetti realized she wanted to know what another woman's reaction would be.
Not at all,
Grifoni answered.
Even if I want him dead?
If he was selling drugs to your son, it's an entirely natural reaction.
Grifoni's voice was filled with Delphic calm.
Would you think the same?
Grifoni clasped her hands and rested them in her lap. Looking at them, she said,
I don't have children, so I can't feel what you do.
Then, before the other woman could speak, she went on, head still lowered.
But I think it's what I'd want, too.
That said, Grifoni raised her head and looked at the other woman, face expressionless. Professoressa Crosera nodded but said nothing. Brunetti saw that his only choice was to pretend that the conversation had been proceeding in linear form since he'd said he wanted her to talk about her husband. He was conscious he'd thought of Fornari as the assailant. Now he had nothing.
We'd like you to tell us about anything unusual your husband did or said in the last few weeks, or anything strange that he might have mentioned or talked about.
Even something in the newspaper he commented on, Grifoni offered, or a subject that angered or excited him.
Professoressa Crosera closed her eyes and raised her right hand to rub at her forehead. She pushed at the skin, as though trying to smooth it up to her hairline.
Tullio's a calm person. It's seldom that he gets angry. He's patient, doesn't yell at the kids. He works hard. What sort of things do you talk about together?
Grifoni risked asking. She had to think about this for a while, as though the man lying in the hospital bed was an obstacle to her memory of the other one, the man she had married.
Our work, both his and mine, the children, films we've seen, our families, where we want to go on vacation.
Her voice had slowed with each subject, and now it stopped. She raised her right hand in a helpless wave.
We talk about what everyone talks about.
Brunetti tried again.
Has he mentioned any trouble at work?
Her glance was sudden, almost fearful. Brunetti interpreted it as a meaning she had never thought that her husband might have been in danger. Reading her expression, he realized how improbable it all sounded. Gasparini worked in Verona, for heaven's sake. How likely was it that some jealous colleague or angry client would come to Venice and roam around the city until he conveniently met his unsuspecting victim on a bridge?
Or someone here in the city with whom he's had trouble of any sort?
Grifoni asked. Professoressa Crosera, who had lowered her head after Brunetti's question about her husband's work, raised it to meet Grifoni's glance.
No, nothing. At least nothing I know about.
Brunetti took the opportunity to say,
Yesterday I asked if I might look through his belongings.
He waited to let her acknowledge his having asked.
Would you let us go through them?
Her face tightened in resistance, but before she could speak, Brunetti remembered her voice when she'd said the word, Good, and he added,
It might help find the person who did this to him.
You believe that?
She asked.
I don't know what will help, Signora,
he admitted, surprised at his own frankness.
That's why I'd like Commissario Grifoni to have a look as well. She might notice something I don't.
Professoressa Crosera put her fingers back on her forehead and made the same upward pushing motion.
Go ahead, then. It's the second door on the left.
They found the room in order. The bed was made. There was no discarded clothing. Brunetti walked over to what must be the door to the bathroom and poked his head inside. Here the same order prevailed, save for a shelf above the sink that held cosmetics and lotions. The wardrobe was a modern white thing, enormous, set in the middle of the far wall of the room. Brunetti pulled open the two doors. One squeaked terribly. They stepped back to get a better view. A row of men's shoes were lined up on the right side. Above them, the waistbands of trousers peaked from below matching jackets, and to the right of those hung a few jackets and at least 20 shirts, all white. The left side held dresses, skirts, slacks, shirts, and two long gowns, all mixed together with no attempt at order. At least a dozen pairs of shoes stood below, some of them next to their partners. Grifoni moved back and stood with her arms folded, as if to get an impression of the two people who shared the space from the state in which they left their respective sections. Three shelves stood to each side of the hanging clothing, three drawers below the shelves. Men's winter hats and gloves sat on the top shelf, beneath them heavy sweaters, and beneath those lighter sweaters and sweatshirts. The feminine side repeated the same contents on the same shelves, though there was considerably less order in their arrangement.
"He's a neat man, wouldn't you say?"
Grifoni asked, pointing with her chin to the piles of folded clothing.
"It looks that way," Brunetti answered, thinking of what must be the dull routine of an accountant's work. "And his wife?" he asked.
Instead of answering, Grifoni stepped closer to the left side of the wardrobe and touched the material of one of the gowns and two of the dresses.
"She knows what suits her."
"I don't understand," Brunetti said.
Grifoni reached up with palms pressed together and slipped them between the two dresses to separate them.
"Look at these," she said. "They're perfect for her. Cut, material, the way they'd fall from the shoulder?"
She removed her hands, and the dresses went back to caressing one another.
"She knows what looks good on her."
"And those?"
Brunetti said, pointing to the shoes below, lying around in drunken disorder.
"They all have wooden shoe trees, Guido. Did you notice that?"
No, he hadn't. He had been too busy seeing that some were not standing neatly next to their mates.
"And at least five pairs are handmade," she added.
"And him?" Brunetti asked,
wondering if he'd be asking her to interpret their handwriting next.
"Orderly, perhaps annoyingly so at times. Very conventional and fixed in his ideas."
"You read all that from the way his suits are lined up?" Brunetti asked.
She smiled.
"He has three gray suits, Guido," she said, pointing to his side of the wardrobe.
She started at the top drawer on the right side and worked her way down, opening, putting a hand inside to move things around, and closing them one after the other. Underwear, socks, and handkerchiefs. She pulled open the third one and looked inside. Instead of reaching in, she put her hands behind her back and said,
"Just look at what we see."
"Meaning?" Brunetti asked, with more than a hint of impatience.
"Meaning that, in the midst of all that order, here we have the secret center of the man."
"Oh, come on, Claudia," Brunetti said. "That's nonsense."
"Just look,"
she said, pulling the drawer out farther and stepping away from it. Brunetti bent over the open drawer and then knelt on the other side to take a better look. It held all manner of things that appear to have been dropped in helter-skelter. There were bunched-up banknotes with Arabic script and portraits of men in headdresses. There was an envelope he found, which, when he opened it, held boarding passes for flights to and from Dubai 4 months before. There were two key rings, with keys that, when they examined them, appeared to be for different locks. There was a small malachite hippopotamus, a receipt for 30 euros spent to charge up his iMob travel card, two separately wrapped cough drops, and a well-worn leather wallet. Brunetti opened it and slipped his finger into the various slots. All were empty, as was the larger slot in the back, where bills were usually kept. Under a few 10-pound notes, he found more receipts, two for restaurants, and one for the purchase of 3 printer cartridges at Testolini. One of those cartridges, black, had somehow got itself into the drawer. Brunetti flipped through some papers held together with a paperclip and found that they were not receipts, but coupons for cosmetics, each for 154 euros, all made out to Gasparini. There were 4 AAA batteries in an unopened package, a flashlight that didn't work, more receipts, and 3 more coupons. He stood and slipped the drawer closed with the toe of his right foot.
"Not so fast, Guido,"
she said, and bent to pull the drawer open again.
"There's no order here. The things have nothing in common, unlike all his other things."
She picked up the envelope and pulled out the stiff pieces of cardboard.
"Why did he keep only these 2 boarding passes? These are people who travel. Didn't you tell me his wife travels a lot for work?"
Brunetti nodded, but he still had no idea what she was talking about. Grifoni pulled the drawer out and set it on the table between the room's 2 windows. One by one, she removed its contents. She placed all of the objects in a long line, running from the drawer to the end of the table, and then back again in a second row. The line began with the boarding passes, and, next to them, the currency printed with the portraits of the men in headdresses. Next, she put down the leather wallet, and next to that, the malachite hippopotamus. The AAA batteries lay beside the printer cartridge. Then came the stack of coupons, the flashlight, the cough drops, the key rings, receipts, currency. More receipts and a few objects not seen before appeared, all in a line that swung around and back to the empty drawer. Grifoni examined the boarding passes.
"People say Emirates is the best airline,"
she said, and put them back into their envelope. She set it down and picked up the flashlight, which still didn't work. She went through everything, picking up each piece, reading and trying to decipher any text she saw. While she was busy studying a hotel bill from Milano, Brunetti picked up the coupons held together by a paperclip. He studied the first one again, and then turned them over one by one, examining each. Finally, he looked at Grifoni and asked, "Why would a man have 900 euros in coupons for cosmetics?" For some reason, he thought of the boys accepting the scandal magazines at the kiosk. Boys didn't read them. Men didn't use cosmetics. At least, not 900 euros worth of them. "It doesn't make any sense, does it?" Brunetti walked over to Grifoni and handed her the papers. She did as he had, examining them one by one.
924, to be exact,
she said, handing them back to Brunetti. "Let's ask her," Brunetti said. He slipped the coupons into the pocket of his jacket, and together they put everything back into the drawer. Failing to find Professoressa Crosera where they had left her, Brunetti and Grifoni walked towards the kitchen. They had not heard the boy enter the apartment, and so were surprised to find him sitting at the table, an enormous sandwich in one hand. His mother sat opposite him, a cup of what might have been tea in front of her. "Oh, excuse me," Brunetti said, stopping abruptly in the open doorway. Grifoni bumped into him with a muffled "Ugh." Professoressa Crosera half rose from her seat. The boy set his sandwich on the plate in front of him and started to get to his feet. Brunetti smiled, and Sandro tried to do the same. He had more color in his face than today, and seemed calmer. He managed a polite,
"Buongiorno, signori,"
and looked at his mother, uncertain what to do.
"Please, don't disturb yourself, signora," Brunetti said. "We have only a few more questions. We'll wait for you in the living room."
Before Professoressa Crosera could say anything, the boy asked,
"Have you found the man who hurt my father?"
He tried to make his voice sound very grown up, but he failed to cover the note of fear in his question.
"Not yet," Brunetti answered. "That's why we'd like to speak to your mother again."
"About what?"
she asked, sounding curious, not offended.
"Some of the things we found, signora," Brunetti said, giving no farther explanation. "We'll wait for you in the salotto," he told her, and turned away from the doorway.
He led Grifoni down the corridor and back into the living room. They sat where they had been and waited for her to return. Professoressa Crosera arrived a few minutes later and closed the door behind her as she came in. Brunetti got to his feet.
"What is it?"
she asked, standing in front of the door.
"We've looked through your husband's belongings, and there's one thing we don't understand," he said, pulling the coupons from his pocket.
She looked at them and, puzzled, asked,
"What are they?"
"Coupons for cosmetics. We don't understand how he could have such a large credit for cosmetics."
Then, remembering what he'd seen, Brunetti added,
"His name is on them."
He passed them to her. She looked through them briefly, then handed them back. She walked over and sat on the sofa, and Brunetti resumed his seat next to Grifoni. She glanced at her watch, as if uncertain that she'd have enough time to explain. She looked as though she were trying to smile and said,
"That's his aunt."
She spoke the noun in a manner that led him to believe she had a great deal more to say about this aunt. Neither of them spoke.
"Zia Matilda," she said with studied neutrality. "Matilde Gasparini. She's the Gasparini on the coupons. For some reason, my husband brought them home the last time he saw her and said he had to talk to someone about them. She's 85, so only God knows what she's doing spending so much money on cosmetics."
Professoressa Crosera sounded displeased at the thought. Brunetti could hardly say anything about the foolishness of women, could he? Nor about the desire not to let go of youth, not to a woman with a husband struggling not to let go of life, and certainly not with Grifoni sitting next to him. All he could think of to say was,
"Did he tell you anything about them?"
Surprised, she answered,
"Only that he didn't understand what she told him about where they came from."
Then she added,
"He went to see her when she came home from the hospital, and that's when he found out about them. She told him that wasn't the moment to trouble her by asking about them."
She smiled and shook her head in memory of what she probably considered her husband's aunt's folly.
"The hospital here?" Brunetti asked, to keep the conversation going.
When she nodded, he asked,
"Why was she there?"
"Her badante couldn't wake her up one morning, so she called an ambulance. We were away, so she didn't reach us for a few days and was very upset."
Brunetti confined himself to an inquisitive tilt of the head, and she continued,
"When Tullio went to the hospital, he found her doctor before he found her. He said she'd apparently mixed up her medicines and taken too many sleeping pills. He said it often happens to old people."
Both Brunetti and Grifoni nodded. Grifoni added a sympathetic noise, as if she, too, had stories to tell about old people.
"Tullio told the doctor that he was her nephew, not her son,
and didn't know much about her health because she'd always been healthy and never spoke about it. He never even learned the name of the doctor. This doctor told him his aunt wasn't as healthy as she seemed to believe, and that her records showed she'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's and was taking medicine for it. There was also a prescription for something against early-onset Alzheimer's.
She raised her eyebrows and closed her eyes for a moment, then went on.
When Tullio finally saw her, he was shocked by the change. He told me she was suddenly an old woman and very confused. She kept telling him to go to her house and get those coupons, because she was afraid Beata, the badante, would steal them. She wouldn't rest until he promised to go that same day.
And did he? Brunetti asked. She nodded.
She made him give his word, so he had no choice but to go and get them.
She shook her head at this and said,
Beata's been with her for 10 years. She's like a daughter to her. It's crazy to think she'd steal anything. Besides, she's had 10 years to do it.
The more she spoke of the aunt, the more exasperated Professoressa Crosera sounded.
She was sent home the next day, this was about 2 weeks ago, and he went to see her there. Twice. She asked him about the coupons again, told him to keep them safe, and he had to promise her that he would.
Have you seen her?
Not since she was taken home, she said. Only my husband goes. Went.
Has anyone told her about your husband?
She shook her head 3 or 4 times.
I called Beata and told her. She hadn't heard anything. I asked her to try to keep the news from his aunt if she could. She said it would be easy because no one comes to visit anymore. Why is that?
Grifoni broke in to ask.
The people who know her are all dead or in nursing homes,
Professoressa Crosera answered with the brusque finality of a closing door. A breathy, ah, escaped Grifoni, who turned to Brunetti for a clue as to what he wanted to do. He took out his notebook, saying,
Could you tell us her address, signora?
You aren't going to talk to her, are you?
Brunetti had learned early on that witnesses would tolerate anything except sarcasm, so he rejected the idea of telling Professoressa Crosera that her husband's aunt would perhaps be more help to them than the malachite hippopotamus. He smiled and said,
The coupons are the only things we've found among your husband's belongings that seem out of place, signora. So I'd like to find out about them, if only to exclude the possibility.
He paused, considering, then asked,
Would you allow me to take them with me?
You won't upset her, will you?
She asked. Grifoni interrupted to say,
No, I give my word.
Professoressa Crosera looked at Grifoni for a few seconds, then gave a quick nod.
And if you don't find out anything?
She asked.
Then we'll have to try to find something else, he said, wishing he had something better to offer her.
She lives opposite the Carmini,
Professoressa Crosera said.
The building just in front of the bridge. I'm sorry, but I don't know the number. If you walk down the middle of the bridge, it's the door you'd walk into. 4th floor. Her name's on the bell.
Brunetti got to his feet. Both women stood. She led them to the door where all three stopped. It was only then that Brunetti remembered he had not asked how her husband was. But the thought had no sooner come to him than Grifoni said,
I wish you strength in this, signora.
She turned to leave. Brunetti followed her out, saying nothing. Chapter 20 As they walked down the steps, Brunetti reflected on the grace of what Grifoni had said. Only a southerner could display deep emotion with such a conventional wish, so simply stated. It was directed at the person in need, aimed at helping her, not at the unconscious victim, who, however much he might be in need of help, willed or bestowed, would never hear or understand it, nor be helped by it in any real way. Not for the first time, Brunetti was aware of the dissonance between his impulse toward suspicion of Southerners and his frequent wonder at their instinctive grace of spirit. Outside the door, Brunetti paused in what another Venetian would recognize as a brief consultation with the GPS implanted in him at birth. There was no greater sign than the quivering needle of a compass makes before finding sharp north or declining west. Path clear, he set out, and Grifoni fell into step beside him. He led them towards Campo Santa Margherita, and then through it the long way and down alongside the Church of the Carmine, until they were in front of the bridge. They stopped to study the building made conspicuous by two central bricked-up windows on the second floor.
"Why'd they do that?" Grifoni asked.
"Structural problems, I'd say. The palazzo is directly on a canal, and they tend to shift around a bit."
"You make it sound so ordinary," she said, smiling.
"I suppose it is."
"But why brick up the windows?"
"They probably realized only after the windows were there that they weakened the wall."
"Hmm,"
she agreed, and started up the bridge. In front of the door, she found the bell for Gasparini, waited for Brunetti to come up and stand beside her, and rang it. After some time, a woman's voice asked through the speakerphone,
"Chi è?"
Brunetti tapped Grifoni's shoulder lightly, and when she looked at him, he pointed at her face. A woman's voice would be far better received than a man's.
"Professoressa Elisa has asked us to stop by and see Signora Gasparini," Grifoni answered in a voice she made sound friendly and warm.
"Signor Tullio's wife?"
"Yes."
"Are you from the hospital?"
"No,"
Grifoni answered.
"The professoressa asked us to pass by and see how Signor Tullio's aunt is."
"Is Signor Tullio all right?"
the woman asked. Grifoni looked at Brunetti, who nodded.
"Yes."
Then added,
"Thanks be to God."
"Ah, yes,"
the woman answered.
"I pray for him every day." "May we come up and speak with her for a moment?"
Grifoni asked.
"Of course, if Professoressa Elisa has sent you."
After a second, the buzzer sounded and the door opened. They entered an enormous, high-ceilinged atrium with the usual white and red checkerboard paving. At the back, large glass doors led to a garden that ran at least a normal city block to a high brick wall. Fruit trees slumbered in damp misery, hunkered down until springtime. The steps in the double flight to the first floor were broad and low, worn away in the center by centuries of feet going up and down. The doors of two separate apartments faced them on the first landing and then again on each successive landing up to the fourth, where there was only one door. Seeing it when they reached the top, Grifoni asked,
"Does that mean the whole floor is hers?"
"Probably," Brunetti answered,
thinking of what the combined size would be. He rang the bell beside it. After a moment, the door was opened by a woman in her mid-thirties, with blonde hair and pale blue eyes. She stepped back to invite them to enter. She wore a white sweater made of some kind of synthetic fabric and a dark skirt that fell to the middle of her calves. Her hair was parted in the middle and fell, straight as a plumb line, to her shoulders. She had the rounded features and pale skin of an Eastern European, and smiled nervously at them. After asking permission to enter, Brunetti stepped aside to allow Grifoni to go in first. The entrance was an enormously long, low-ceilinged room made even lower by dark beams running from side to side. Even the light that came from the windows at the back, windows that must overlook the garden, did little to brighten the room. The dark wooden floor managed to trap even more light.
The signora is in her room,
the woman said, turning towards the back of the house. They passed two long tapestries that hung facing one another. Brunetti saw dark stags being speared by faded human figures in one, boars in the other, and was glad of the lack of light. Farther on there were portraits of men on one wall, women facing them, staring across at the other sex, both sides in need of restoration and better spirits. The young woman stopped in front of a door on the right and said,
"The signore is in here. You won't say anything that will upset her, will you?"
Voice growing confidential, while pleading for their understanding, she added,
"She's not the same as she was."
Her sadness was real, Brunetti thought.
"We'll certainly try not to, signorina."
She tried to smile, and dipped low in something that resembled a curtsy, but might have been a genuflection. Then she opened the door and stepped into a room as dim as the corridor.
"Some friends of Signor Tullio are here, signora,"
she announced in a falsely bright voice. She took two steps into the room and turned to wave the men behind her. As soon as they were inside, she repeated the curtsy and left, closing the door behind her. A tiny woman with flame-red, curly hair, cut into a youthful cap suitable for a far younger person, was seated in a low chair in front of the windows, her feet raised and resting on a brocade-covered footstool. What light there was came in from her right side. Her blue silk jacket was patterned with interwoven red dragons, and her skirt, striped gray and green in some shiny fabric that might have been satin, fell to her ankles. On her feet she had the sort of open-backed, high-heeled bedroom slippers Brunetti had only seen in opera or in Longhi's portraits. They even had the fuzzy ruff over the instep. She could have been waiting to host a dinner party or preparing to perform in a Christmas pantomime. The immobility of her face might have been the result of surgery badly performed, although, Brunetti reflected, it might as easily reflect a lack or loss of interest in what lay beyond this room. Her eyes were cloudy, not only with the faint smokiness that often comes with advanced age, but with a vague uncertainty about the reality they perceived. Her mouth was as red as her hair, and just as thin. The only animation, and Brunetti flinched from the word, came from the occasional jerks and tremors of her head, which snapped to the left with no predictable rhythm. Brunetti tried to time the motions, but they came when they wanted, after 3 seconds, or 5, or 1. She sat in the chair as though that were her occupation. There was no cup or glass on the table near her, no fruit, no chocolates, no book or magazine. She looked at them and gave a regal wave to a row of chairs that faced her, as if part of her time were spent in giving audiences. They sat. Around them stood large, dark, awkward pieces of furniture. The chairs seemed too padded, or too high, or too low. Some were merely too ugly. One wardrobe tilted to the right and seemed in imminent danger of collapse. A table had legs that appeared to be suffering from elephantiasis, and a mirror had grown moldy with age. The pieces looked like family heirlooms from a family with no taste.
"Your friends of my nephew?"
she asked in place of greeting.
"Si, signora," Brunetti said.
Grifoni nodded and gave a small, affirmative smile. The woman barely looked at her. Every so often her head shot quickly to the left and then back. Brunetti made himself ignore it.
"Why hasn't he been to see me?"
Her voice sought anger but found only petulance.
"He's very busy, signora. You know he has to travel for his work," Brunetti answered, blocking out the image of the man in the hospital bed.
"But he comes to see me before he leaves,"
she said uncertainly. as though in search of confirmation from Brunetti. Her voice was weak and tended to drop off in the final words of a sentence.
"Unfortunately, this trip was very sudden, so he asked us to come and tell you," Brunetti risked saying.
"When will—"
she began, but then seemed to forget what it was she wanted to say. Or perhaps the future tense was difficult for her.
"He asked us," Brunetti began, as though he had not noticed that she had failed to finish the sentence, "to bring his greetings, and to ask you to help him understand something."
"Understand what?"
she asked. "He's been trying to help with the coupons you gave him."
Brunetti left the sentence open, half question, half statement, suggesting she confirm or deny. She shifted her feet so quickly that one of the slippers fell to the floor. As with the jerking motion of her head, Brunetti pretended not to notice it. In fact, everyone in the room pretended not to notice it.
"Coupons?"
she asked in a voice that now had a quaver, as though the question had pushed her over the edge into advanced, befuddled old age.
"Yes. The ones from the Farmacia della Fontana. It seems the pharmacist is willing now to redeem them in cash."
The prospect of cash seemed to rejuvenate her. The hesitant manner of an old woman vanished, replaced by a younger woman's ardent curiosity. Brunetti suddenly found himself thinking of something his mother had told him when he was a boy, one of her attempts to suggest to him what the world was like, without, of course, revealing that this was what she was doing. He had said—he must have been 14 or 15—that he thought Venetians were different from other people, but he wasn't sure how. They'd been in the kitchen, and she was wiping her hands on the apron that was as much a part of her as was her wedding ring.
"We're greedy, Guido. It's in our marrow," she'd said.
And that was the only answer he got.
"He said that?"
Signora Gasparini asked.
"In cash?"
Brunetti said, "Yes," and Grifoni nodded. The old woman moved her head, this time voluntarily and up and down, and glanced towards something they couldn't see. Her face went slack in thought. Silence expanded. Brunetti could think of nothing to say or ask.
"When will Tullio be back?"
the old woman asked.
"Ah, I don't know, signora. He said he'd be gone at least until the end of next week. That's why he asked us to stop by and see how you are and ask if you need anything."
She gave him a long look, and Brunetti could all but see her trying to gaze into his soul to discover what sort of man he was.
"It's hard for Elisa and the kids," he said with easy familiarity, "with him away for so long."
Brunetti turned to Grifoni, as though he'd just remembered she was sitting there with him.
"Did he tell you when he'd be back, Claudia?"
"No, he didn't. But we have a date for dinner with them on the 20th, haven't we?"
Brunetti nodded and turned back to Signora Gasparini.
"He'll be back then, by the end of next week," Brunetti assured her, smiling to show his pleasure at that fact.
"That's a long time,"
the old woman pointed out.
"Oh, it will pass quickly," Brunetti said airily and shifted forward as though about to get to his feet.
The old woman held up a hand.
"You didn't tell me your names."
"I'm Guido Brunetti, and this is Claudia Grifoni."
"Is she your wife?"
Signora Gasparini asked. It was Grifoni who interrupted to say,
"As good as, signora,"
and give a breathy laugh. If Brunetti had expected the old woman to be surprised by this, he was mistaken. She turned her attention to Grifoni, looking at her for the first time. For as long as she kept her eyes on Grifoni, Brunetti counted out 9 beats, her head did not move. But when she said,
"So you do things together?"
the small tremors began again. Given Grifoni's last remark, Brunetti wasn't quite certain what she had in mind. Grifoni apparently felt no confusion, for she answered,
"Yes, we do, Signora. We shop together and share household expenses. Guido still pays for dinner, though, if we go out."
This seemed to satisfy the woman, for she said,
"So you'll go together to get the money?" "Of course,"
Grifoni assured her.
"We're used to working as a team."
She smiled at the other woman to acknowledge the ambiguity of what she'd just said. Then, as though suddenly recalling a missing detail, Grifoni added,
"But we need to know what to tell the pharmacist."
Suddenly alert, Signora Gasparini said,
"Are you Venetian?"
It was a request for information, entirely neutral.
"No, I'm not, Signora, but I live here now,"
Grifoni said, and gave Brunetti a long look.
"Ah, that's good,"
the woman said, and actually rubbed her hands together, a gesture Brunetti had read about in the novels of Balzac. He turned to Grifoni, as though his role as leader was finished, and now it was time to turn things over to the person who would deal with the details.
"All right, Claudia. I'll leave you here with Signora Gasparini and ask the Badante if there's anything else we can do."
He got to his feet in an energetic, masculine way, went to the door, and let himself out. At the back of the house, he stopped and called,
"Signorina! Signorina Beata!"
He took a few more steps to the door at the end of the corridor. He raised his voice and called again,
"Signorina Beata, are you here?"
The door opened, and the young woman emerged into the hallway, wiping her hands on a kitchen towel.
"How can I help you, signore?"
she asked. Her Italian, Brunetti noticed, was excellent, with only a vowel here and there to show that it was an imported product.
"Signor Tullio told his wife that he's seen changes in his aunt in the last months," Brunetti began, putting as much concern into his voice as he could.
He waited for her response, which was a quick nod that could as easily be confirmation of the fact as acknowledgment that she had understood his statement. Her silence left him with no choice but to be more direct.
"Have you noticed changes in her too, signorina?"
She wiped her hands again, although they must by now have been dry.
"She doesn't remember things like she used to,"
she said, and looked at him to assure herself that he understood. When Brunetti nodded, she continued,
"It didn't happen when the shaking disease began."
She dismissed this idea with a swift unfurling of the towel.
"She remembered to take her pills, and the shaking wasn't so bad."
Brunetti nodded again.
"Then she started having trouble sleeping. Sometimes I found her asleep on the sofa in the morning with the television on, and she didn't remember how she got there."
The young woman seemed more troubled by this than by the shaking disease.
"Then that stopped, and she started sleeping later in the morning. Until one time I couldn't wake her up and called 118.
She folded the towel into a rectangle, shook it out, and folded it again.
"When was that, signorina?"
Brunetti asked, wanting to confirm what Professoressa Crosera had told him.
"In the middle of October," she said. "I remember because she came home on the last day of October, and it had been 2 weeks."
She closed her eyes for a moment, perhaps remembering that day, and then said,
"She's not getting better, so I think I won't be able to go home for Christmas."
"Is that when you noticed the changes in her?"
"I didn't notice for a long time, because the changes were so small. But when she came home from the hospital, there was a big change. It used to be that we went out every day to do the errands. We'd go to the supermarket in Santa Margherita together and decide what to get for dinner or have a coffee and a pastry."
She gave him a long look, as though deciding whether she could tell him more. Apparently she could, for she said,
It was like we were friends. One day she'd pay, and the next day she'd let me pay. And for that time, while we had a coffee and ate the pastry, we really were friends.
Brunetti was busy doing the maths. 15 times a month, times 5 or 6 euros, 75 euros. He thought of his mother's admonition about the Venetians and greed, to which he added cunning.
And then, at the end of the month, she'd give me all the money back, saying it was so I could buy a pair of shoes or send something to my mother.
Beata smiled at the memory. After he digested this, Brunetti asked, "What other errands did you do together?"
"Sometimes we'd go to Rialto, too. Or we'd look in shop windows and talk about the things we saw. Or I'd go with her to her doctor or to the pharmacy, and once to get her eyes checked."
"When she began to change, did you worry?" Brunetti asked.
The young woman busied herself folding the towel again while she thought about this.
"Not really, because it was so slow. Just sometimes, or with some things."
"Could you give me an example, signorina?"
"She didn't want me to come in with her when she went to the doctor anymore, or to go to the pharmacy with her, even though it's in Cannareggio. She began to ask me to leave the room when she wanted to make a phone call, and she wouldn't let me help her keep track of when she should take her medicines."
She gave Brunetti time to comment, but he did not.
"I think she was embarrassed because the shaking was getting worse, and sometimes she'd mix things up. I pretended not to notice, but she knew that I did."
Beata gave him a quick glance and tried to shrug away what she had just said.
"We still went for coffee together, but it wasn't the same as before. And she always paid. I kept offering, but she said no. So I didn't enjoy it as much, because we weren't like friends anymore. She was always the padrona, and that's not nice, not once you've been friends."
She left that in the air a long time, then added, in a voice that failed to disguise her sadness,
"I think she forgot that we'd become friends."
Brunetti was afraid she was going to cry, and so he asked abruptly,
"Do you know anything about the coupons?"
"What coupons?"
she asked. "From the pharmacy. For cosmetics."
Her surprise was palpable, and as he watched, she glanced away from him and down the corridor, as if she could see the past there, though in better focus.
"So that's where they came from,"
she said.
"The coupons?" Brunetti asked.
"No, the things she gave me. This summer, just after my birthday, she came home with a bag of lipsticks and face creams and a bottle of bath oil, and gave it all to me."
The smile had come back to her face.
"She'd already given me a birthday present, a gold chain with a cross. I'm going to give it to my mother when I go home in the summer to visit."
"So the cosmetics were an extra present?"
"Yes. She said she'd been given them. I want to take them when I go home."
Her smile dimmed a little.
"There's no reason to use them here, anyway."
"Could I see them?" Brunetti asked.
"What?"
"Would you show them to me?"
"But they're in my room,"
she said, as though Brunetti had made an improper suggestion.
"Perhaps you could go and get them, then, Beata. I'd like to see them."
She gave him such a troubled look that Brunetti was forced to say,
"It might help the signora."
Beata nodded and crossed the hall to go into a room on the other side. She was quickly back with an orange Hermes shopping bag in her hand, and Brunetti thought for a moment that the cosmetics had come from there. Seeing his face, Beata said,
"No, signore. The signora put them in this bag because she knew I liked it."
She placed the bag on one of the large chests in the hall and removed, one by one, all the items in it. There were four lipsticks, a bottle of bath oil, another one, a small box that held a tub of face cream, and three tubes of something called fondo tinto.
"She gave them to you this summer, and you haven't used them yet?" Brunetti asked.
"No, signora. I want to take it all home with me next summer and give it to my mother and sister. They've never had things this good."
She gave the tubes and boxes a glance filled with longing and near reverence, as though concentrated in them were all the wealth and luxury of the West.
"Thank you, Signorina Beata," Brunetti said. "Do you know if the signora brought home more things like this?"
"I think she did, but earlier in the summer, and then she didn't any more."
"Was this after she stopped asking you to go out with her every day?"
"How did you know that?"
"Oh, it was just a guess," Brunetti said easily.
The door to the signora's room opened, and Grifoni came into the hallway, turned and blew a kiss into the room, and then came towards them. To Beata she said,
"The signora would like you to bring her a cup of tea."
Brunetti watched the young woman stop herself from dropping another curtsy.
"Of course,"
she said, and walked towards the kitchen.
"How do you do it?" Brunetti asked, not having to mention the kiss she tossed towards the old woman.
"By listening, and asking questions, and then wanting to know more."
She glanced at the cosmetic set out on top of the chest, lined up like the row of objects from Gasparini's drawer. She picked up the box and opened the lid, careful not to bend the cardboard flap. Carefully, she pulled out the pale blue plastic tub and read the label.
"I looked at this 2 weeks ago. There are 150 grams in here, and it costs 97 euros."
She slipped the tub into the box and reinserted the tab. She opened all of the lipsticks one by one and showed Brunetti that they were unused.
"I should tell my nephews in Naples not to get mixed up in selling drugs, not when they could sell this stuff," she said.
Brunetti let the remark pass. Grifoni had seldom spoken of her family, and he did not want to sound intrusive. But he had to admit she had a natural sense of the realities of the marketplace.
"Well?" he asked.
"She told me a bit about her youth."
That said, Grifoni started to replace the tubes and boxes in the bag, careful to place them neatly beside one another on the bottom, setting the tubes and lipsticks upright. She held up one of the tubes and said,
"I asked her what her secret was for looking so young."
She stopped then and looked at Brunetti, giving him a visual prod.
"And she told you what?"
"To stay away from doctors and use the best cosmetics,"
she said, waving the tube back and forth.
"So she paid for all of this?" Brunetti asked.
"Yes. She started to tell me she'd found a way to do it that saved her money, but then she clapped her hand over her mouth and said it was a secret and she couldn't tell anyone."
"What did you do?" Brunetti asked.
A door opened and Beata emerged, carrying a tray with a single cup of tea and three sweet biscuits on a plate. Brunetti went ahead and opened the door for her, then followed her into the room. When the old woman looked up at him, he said,
"Thank you, signora, for your help. I hope we haven't tired you with our questions."
"Not at all,"
Signora Gasparini said, smiling vaguely towards him.
"Please say hello to my nephew when you see him. And perhaps you could ask him to call me."
Then she reached to take the cup of tea Beata handed her. She looked up and said, smiling,
"That young woman is charming."
"Yes, she is, isn't she?"
Brunetti said, and left the room, closing the door behind him. Grifoni waited for him in the hallway, all of the items back in the bag, which now stood in the center of the chest. They left the apartment, and Grifoni did not start to speak until they reached the bridge in front of the building. She stopped at the top and leaned back against the railing, arms stiff and